I came this morning from camping. I was actually camping with my kids this weekend, not far from here, probably only about 10 miles if you could go directly over the hills to Memorial Park. I used to camp a lot when I was a kid, and I stopped pretty much when I was an adult and have only started again recently now that my kids are old enough to enjoy it. And I remember when I first started doing retreats at places like Jikoji and San Francisco Zen Center and elsewhere, do sesshins, and Jikoji wasn't quite as nice back then, so the beds were hard and it felt a little more rustic than it does now. And I remember one of the things I used to like about sesshins is that it would sort of remind me of camping, because it was not as comfortable as you're used to. You'd go to sleep early, you'd wake up pretty much with the light. And sesshins were always difficult for me, but I took some comfort in those memories, that it would make me think about those happy times as camping as a kid. But anyways, last night I realized that now when I go camping, it reminds me of being on sesshin. and so it's sort of fun to go from that to wake up and come right here. It made me think maybe we should have a camping sesshin where we all sleep outside. The other thing that I've started doing in the last few years, now that I have children, is that I've gotten involved in teaching Buddhism to kids. And some of you have heard me talk about that before, both with my own kids, but also I've started helping out at the Insight Meditation Center down in Redwood City that actually has a fairly active youth program. And I assist Misha Merrill, a Zen teacher, in teaching the elementary school kids there once a month. And one of the great things, I think, about trying to work with children is it does force me to think about what's really essential about our practice, our teaching. Because you can't explain too much. I think a lot of the things that we usually talk about are sort of hard for kids to understand, and maybe not even really possible for kids to understand. The notion that life is suffering, I think, it isn't really true for kids. Life actually isn't suffering for them yet. They have to learn how to suffer. And to try to convince them that life is suffering seems like a bad idea. They have to discover that for themselves. But one of the things that I always come back to is really two things. The first is the middle way, which really was the Buddha's first teaching, and sort of the source for everything, I think, that we do. And the other is the Buddha's last teaching, which was that we all have to find our own way, to find our own path, and that we can't rely too much on the things we hear from others. In a sense, the middle way is the teaching of balance. And this being a light unto ourselves, that's the teaching of finding that balance within ourselves. So of course we have some help in finding our own way. And I often think about it in terms of three kinds of help that we're offered. So the first kind is the teachers we have. My teacher was the founder of this temple, Kobun Chino Hodagawa Roshi. and now Michael Newhall, who's taken over the temple since Coben's passed. But of course, we have many teachers in the West, and it's one of the blessings we have these days that so many teachers are available to us in trying to find this balance. Then the other kind of help we have are our practices, things like the sitting we did this morning, the chanting, these traditions that have been handed down to us to help us in this effort. And then the last kind of help that we have are really stories of other people and their journeys, and sort of examples of how people have approached this in the past. So why do we need teachers? Well, at some level we don't. The Buddha didn't really have a teacher. He had many teachers, but in the end he decided to leave them all. But I think we tend to gravitate to teachers. I know that I do. Because it's someone who's gone through this before. It's someone who's able to share their own experience of trying to find this balance. But I think, of course, in working with teachers, we have to find our own sort of middle way between over-reliance and under-reliance. And I think it's very easy to fall into each side. I know for myself, there's a strong temptation to want to find that teacher who can just give us everything that we need and to give up on the idea of really finding this path for ourselves. On the other hand, the other extreme is sometimes equally tempting, and again for myself, after Copincino passed away, for several years I didn't pursue a teacher at all, because I felt now that he was gone, perhaps I should just really be on my own. And trying to find that balance of getting support from our teachers without asking too much of them and sort of forsaking this instruction we have to, in the end, find the way for ourselves is one of our challenges. So why do we have these practices? The second kind of help we have. Well, a little like the teachers, these are sort of things that have worked for other people, things that have worked before. And I think to some extent there's almost a natural selection of practices. The practices that seem to work and to help people find wisdom. The people who practice those practices become our teachers and pass them down to future generations. And so these are sort of techniques that have stood the test of time, in some cases, a couple thousand years, and have helped our ancestors with their own path. And these practices themselves have their own sort of middle way, their own balance between adaptation and continuity. Some of the things we do have barely changed since the Buddha's time, I think. In some ways, the sitting we do is the same sitting that people have always done. It's hard to change sitting very much. Most of our postures even are the same postures that have been taught for that long. But lots of other practices we have changed a lot. Some of them have changed as Buddhism moved from India through China, Japan, over to here. The chants that we did today, the Heart Sutra that we chanted essentially the Japanese transliteration of the sutra. If you were at a temple in Japan, it would sound more or less like that. They probably get the rhythm a little better than we do. But if you were in China, it would sound a little different. I used to practice with Vietnamese Zen monks, and it sounds a little different again. And some days we chant that sutra entirely in English, which of course is something that would never have happened until Buddhism came to the West. And we've adapted our schedule. In the Buddhist time, for a long time they had fairly loose schedules. They adopted a kind of a calendar of doing retreats during the rainy season. And that's evolved over the years to the sort of schedule we have now, where we occasionally have these longer practice periods. We had one in the fall, but they're not tied to any particular season. And we do these shorter retreats, sometimes just a few days, sometimes as long as a week, scattered throughout the year. And so again, there's this sort of middle way between tradition and adaptation. With all these things, we have to find what still works for us and what we may need to continue to evolve. So why do we use stories? I think in some ways this is the hardest question. Because our practice really, fundamentally, is about facing our own reality, our own experience. And stories can sometimes take us out of the present, away from the reality we actually experience here, into some faraway place or distant time. And that can seem quite counterproductive. Yet at the same time, stories have always been part of our tradition, starting with the Buddha's own story, his life, which is told and retold by all branches of Buddhism. And I think the hope with these stories is that, like the teachers, like the practices, these can serve as examples of what is possible, what others have been through, and that we can start to see ourselves in these stories and think about how our own path might be similar to the paths of all these who have gone before. So I've been reading recently the story of Hui Neng. It's told in what's usually called the Platform Sutra. Hui Neng is our sixth patriarch, which means we usually start the patriarchs at Bodhidharma, although there's a lineage that goes earlier than that, all the way back to the Buddha, but the Zen patriarchs start with Bodhidharma. He's the first. So the sixth is not very much later. And his story's one of the classic, maybe even the classic, Zen story. Takes place around 1,300 years ago in China. It starts with Hui Neng, born, I think, basically into poverty, or at least certainly far from great wealth, in I guess what was considered a backward part of China. Some of the Vietnamese Zen practitioners claim that maybe Huy Nang was actually from Vietnam, which was culturally part of China at the time and was considered sort of like a poor relation. But I don't think anyone other than the Vietnamese think that. But it sort of shows, the story has become so important that everybody wants to claim Huy Nang. So he's born, I think, in this, to a poor family, uneducated. And one day he hears someone, I think, chanting the Diamond Sutra, another important sutra in those days, and actually still today, it was common to memorize that sutra. And so someone was reciting it from memory, I think, and Huy Nang was impressed and was inspired to practice. And went off to a monastery. And the temple he went to was the temple of Master Hung Jen, who was the fifth patriarch, so the direct descendant of Bodhidharma. So I think already in this story, I think there's a lot, at least, that I can relate to, and I think maybe many modern students can relate to, the idea that we have that sort of moment of inspiration where we're driven to practice and we go off to find a teacher and a place to practice. And in some ways it's a little bit of a compliment to the Buddha's own story. The Buddha was born in privilege. Most of us were not. There were, I can't remember all the details. I think a magical white elephant appeared when he was born. That probably didn't happen to most of us. Wise men, you know, proclaimed that he was going to become either a great king or a great sage. So there are all these signs that he was somehow destined for greatness. And I think with Huy Nang, the sense that's passed down to us is that there were no such signs with him. He was just an ordinary person, perhaps someone who most would have imagined was quite unlikely to achieve anything great. So he goes to this temple and he meets Hung Jen, and because he's illiterate and he's from a poor, I think, farming family, they're fairly skeptical about taking him on as a monk, but I guess they let him do it and they assign him to some sort of menial work. These training monasteries were quite large, so he was off in some corner sweeping floors or something like that, and he starts living there and he starts practicing. And one day, and I don't think it's clear from the story why at this particular moment this happens, but the master, Hung Jen, decides that he wants to find his successor. And at least in the version I read, it didn't seem that he was near death or anything like that, but he just decided he needed to find his successor, and he was sort of looking around the temple at everybody there, and I think the sense is he was a little disappointed with the quality of the practice of his students, and he thought maybe if he announced that he was going to appoint his successor, that they would kind of smarten up a little bit and take things more seriously. So he made this proclamation. I'll just read it. This is Red Pine's translation. One day the fifth patriarch suddenly called all of his disciples together. After they had assembled, he said, "I've told you that the greatest concern for a human being is life and death. But you disciples spend your days making offerings, just looking for ways to reap merit, and not for a way out of the bitter sea of samsara, suffering. If you're blind to your own nature, how can you find the doorway to merit? Go back to your rooms and look into yourselves. Those of you who are wise, make use of the prajna wisdom of your own nature. Each of you write me a gatha, short verse. When I read your gathas, "If any of you understands what is truly important, I will give you my robe and my dharma and appoint you the sixth patriarch. Hurry, as if there were a fire." What struck me about this passage is, in a sense, that now, 1,300 years later, you can sort of still imagine somebody saying that to all of us. That there was still this challenge of trying to find authentic practice, in a sense that not everybody was practicing as seriously as they could, that some people were sort of going through the motions. So the story goes that they all went back to their rooms, and they all were kind of nervous about this, about sort of exposing themselves, presenting themselves to the teacher. And all the students were talking among themselves. They all decided that really there was no way they were going to be anointed the sixth patriarch, because there was this senior student, Shen Shu, I think was his name. And he was kind of the master's favorite, and he had been there the longest, I think, or at least had risen highest in kind of the temple hierarchy. And he was definitely going to get it. And so there was really no point anybody else writing anything. And so nobody else wrote anything. And then Shen Shu, in a way, had the same thought. Of course it's going to be me, he thought, because I'm the senior student. But he was also a little nervous because he felt like he was on the spot now, that everybody knew it should be him, but he had to write this gatha, this verse. And so I think the story is he was, you know, up all night. He was not very happy about this situation, but he felt like he had to prove himself. And so in the morning, he pulled it together and he went to the hall and he wrote a gatha on the wall, I think. The gatha he wrote, which has become famous, is this. "The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust." And in the morning, everybody saw this and was very impressed, and the master, Hung Jen, saw it and I think announced that, you know, this was pretty good. And so everyone assumed that Shen Shu was going to become the sixth patriarch. But then the story goes that secretly, Master Hung Jen was actually not that impressed with this verse. And so he was a little stuck about what to do, because nobody else had come up with anything. And then Hui Neng, while he was, I think, sweeping floors or something like that, came across the verse, and he knew it hadn't been there before. And he was illiterate, so he couldn't read it, but he asked one of the other students to read it. And so one of the other students read him the verse. And he didn't like it at all. And he immediately said, you know, "Can somebody help me write one?" Since he couldn't write. And so a student came and he dictated a verse to the student. And that verse was, "Bodhi doesn't have any trees. This mirror does not have a stand. Our Buddha nature is forever pure. Where do you get this dust?" And later, the master saw Huineng's verse. And there, actually, the story gets a little bit strange, and I want to talk a little about that. But the master says, sort of disparages the verse, says, you know, this student doesn't get it either. But then later that night, he calls Hui Neng to his room and gives the transmission to Hui Neng, gives him his robe and tell Sui Neng to leave the temple and go continue the lineage elsewhere. So he sort of transmits to him in secret, and Hui Neng leaves and goes and continues the lineage that we practice to this day. So I think it's a great story. We still tell stories like this about kind of underdogs, people who come from nowhere and manage to upturn things. And I think in some ways it shows that, you know, how little has changed, that there's still this tension between kind of hierarchy and maybe real wisdom, that our egos can get in the way, all those students being unwilling to essentially present themselves to their teacher because they were sure that they would not be good enough. And then even the teacher's decision to transmit in secret, and I think the implication is he thought that although he recognized Hui Neng's wisdom, that because he was poor and illiterate and from this backward southern district, that he might not be accepted. And so he sort of sent him away. And I think the story even goes on to say that some people chased after him to try to get the robe back, but they didn't catch him. But the other thing I think about this story that's very interesting are those gathas, those verses that were written. And when I was reading the story again this week, I have to admit that when I read the first gatha that the arrogant student wrote, I actually thought it was pretty good. I'll just read it again. The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. You know, I thought it wasn't bad when I read it. But then when I did get a couple pages later to Hui Neng's, I had to admit, it sounded like he had the deeper understanding. Bodhi doesn't have any trees. This mirror doesn't have a stand. Our Buddha nature is forever pure. Where do you get this dust? And I think that also illustrates a tension in our practice, that many of us come to this practice with the idea of wanting to fix ourselves, to get the dust off the mirror, to be able to see ourselves more clearly. And I think maybe that's even an unavoidable kind of motivation, because the practice is difficult enough that if you really believed that you were perfect, I don't know if you could get yourself up that early and sitting that long. And yet as we practice, that's the lesson we learn. That really it's just a matter of returning to our true nature, seeing ourselves as we already are, and that there really isn't any dust. And so the practice is subtle. It can feel sometimes like we want to, you know, take a Brillo pad or something to our minds and just kind of scrub it away, get rid of all the ego, all the stress, the worry, the sort of pointless concerns. But that actually isn't the practice at all. The practice is just to kind of go still. Stop scrubbing. And just kind of let things settle where they are. And that's sort of this middle way of practice. That it requires effort, but that too much effort in itself can become a barrier. It requires a balance of effort and non-effort. And I think it also perhaps illustrates a middle way of our own understanding. Sometimes we think we know nothing, like all those students who wouldn't write Agatha. Sometimes we think we know everything, like the senior student Shen Shu. And we have to find that balance, to trust ourselves that we do know something, but to also acknowledge that we have things to learn from others and from other experiences. But I guess the thing I take away most from Huineng is this sort of promise that real understanding is possible for all of us. That we don't need a royal birth or, you know, miraculous white elephants. That each of us, wherever we start from, has the capability to achieve real understanding. And not through magic or divine intervention, but just through these simple practices that were handed down from Bodhidharma through Hongzhen and Huineng all the way to us. So I don't like to talk too long on these Sundays. I know we have one speaker, Peter, who doesn't like to talk at all. We have other teachers who like to talk a long time. That's why I'm looking for that middle way, talking a little. So I thought I would stop there. But usually what we do is just see if...
What right effort means, and you know, letting go, I guess, seems to be part of that.
I think that's an excellent point. I think... So that question has been with us really from the beginning. So when the Buddha decided to reject these ascetic practices and went off and sat under the Bodhi tree and had his enlightenment, the story goes, he accepted some, I think it's milk,
rice from
a young girl, so that he had the energy to sit. And he met up again with his companions afterwards, who were continuing these ascetics, continuing these practices, and they initially rejected him because they said that he had been weak, that it was a cop-out, essentially, that this a middle way was just a way of saying that things were getting too hard. And so that criticism has been there from the beginning. And in a sense, the extremes are always easy to find. It's easy to know what to do if you decide that you just want to live a life of total indulgence, because you'll just do whatever feels good in every moment. And to some extent, it's relatively easy to find the other extreme too. If you want to be an ascetic, you just have to do whatever is unpleasant and just continue to push yourself further and further in that direction, and there are still people who do that. But you're right that the middle way is hard to find, because no one can really tell you where in between those extremes it really lies. And there's disagreement. So there's still forest traditions in Thailand and Burma, elsewhere in Southeast Asia, that still practice these fairly ascetic precepts that I would consider, at least for myself, too extreme. On the other hand, there's lots of people who would say that the sesshins that we do, getting up at 4:30 in the morning, sitting for, you know, as much as 12, 16 hours a day, that's too hard. That's leaning too far towards asceticism. So that's why I say that I think the Buddha's instruction to find our own way is kind of essential to this idea of the middle way, because no one really can tell you where it is. And it is going to be in different places for different people. And, you know, I think there are times where I've certainly felt that our own practice was pushing myself too hard. And yet, I think there are other times where, you know, that pushing was necessary for me. So I think there's no alternative to just trying to find it on your own, and to some extent trusting in the teachers and practices that are handed down to us. But on the other hand, to be willing to question whether these are the path that's going to work for you. And thank you for the question.